welcome to Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption. Today we're going to be talking about an absolutely fascinating procedure, or a new procedure, that's being touted as a potential alternative to IVF. It is intravaginal culture, also goes by IVC. I am so looking forward to this show. I think you are really going to enjoy it. Here's a sample of what you're going to hear.
In the pilot study that we did, we accepted women up to age 38, and we included at that time only predicted normal responders, those with AMHs that weren't too high or too low. And in that group, we had chemical pregnancy rates in both groups of 70%, clinical pregnancy rates in both groups of 65%, you know, sonogram-identified gestational sac and heartbeat, but live birth rates were 55% in the vaginal culture arm and 60% in the traditional laboratory incubator arm. Again, these were all using the mild stimulations. Is that a big enough, as you said, is that a big enough group of patients to really know what the success rates are at every age or if there are any subtle differences? Absolutely not. We need more detail.
I'm Dawn Davenport. I'm the director of Creating a Family. We are the National Infertility and Adoption Education and Support Nonprofit. You can find us online at creatingafamily.org. One of the things that we do here at Creating a Family is produce resources. We add about 4 resources a week to our site. And one resource that we have that I think you will be particularly interested in is a multimedia guide we have on how to choose an infertility clinic. It's about 50 pages, just chock full of information, including how to interpret the SART stats that we refer you to all the time, questions to ask, how to evaluate an embryology lab, all sorts of questions all sorts of things that you need to think about when choosing an infertility clinic. To get to this resource, you can go to our website, creatingafamily.org. Hover over the word resources and click on e-guides, and it will take you right there. The Creating a Family radio show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. Ferring has recently launched their My Fertility Navigator. My Fertility Navigator offers free one-on-one support for women who are struggling to get pregnant and are unsure at that point where and how to begin their fertility journey. Once enrolled, women can receive personalized guidance from a live, dedicated fertility navigator who can help provide important information about fertility, a list of nearby fertility centers, information about how to afford infertility treatment, and much more. To get more information, you can go to their website, myfertilitynav.com/CAF. And the CAF just tells them that you came to them through us. CAF stands for Creating a Family. So again, that would be myfertilitynav.com/CAF. This show, as well as all the resources provided by Creating a Family, could not and would not happen without the generous support from our gold sponsors, who believe in our mission of providing unbiased education and support to those struggling to create a family. Some of our wonderful gold sponsors include Cellmatics. They are the next generation in women's health. The next generation in women's health, transforming how women approach their lifelong fertility journey through genomics and the use of big data. The company's products include Fertilome, which is the world's first comprehensive genetic test that reveals what a woman's DNA says about her reproductive health, and Polaris. It is a real-time predictive analytics platform. It's being used by leading fertility centers across the United States. We also have Manhattan Cryobank. They are dedicated to helping clients have healthy babies by analyzing a client's DNA in combination with the DNA of prospective sperm donors to provide the client with a personalized catalog of safer donor matches. And we have Reproductive Medicine Associates of New Jersey. They are a recognized scientific and patient care leader in the field of infertility. With 10 offices and 21 physicians throughout New Jersey, they maintain an IVF delivery rate well above the national average. And they offer the latest and validated technical solutions to help hopeful parents increase their chances of success in the shortest time possible. In addition to those sponsors, we also have other sponsors whose generosity allows us to bring you this show. So when choosing an infertility service provider, please choose one from the Creating a Family directories, which you can find on our website. You can search by location, services provided, years in operation, just a host of factors that we think are important when choosing. And when using these directories, you help those who help us, and we thank you. Today we're going to be talking about a new procedure. It's actually not new, but we'll talk about that in a little bit. Intravaginal culture. It is a new form of fertility treatment. Our guest today to talk about it is Dr. Kevin Duty. He is the current president of the Society for Assisted Reproductive Technology, which our audience as well knows about, and we often refer to it as SART, their acronym. He is a board-certified reproductive endocrinologist with the Center for Assisted Reproduction, also goes by CARE, C-A-R-E, Fertility, and he is the medical director and on the board of directors for Invivo Bioscience, which manufactures InvoCell, which is a intravaginal cultural system. Welcome, Dr. Duty, to Creating a Family.
Thank you, Donna. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I think we really need to ground our discussion because we're comparing I keep calling it a new system when, in fact, I don't actually think it is brand new, but we're comparing something, and I think it helps to, when comparing, to establish the baseline of what we're comparing it to. Now, most of our audience well knows IVF and IUI, but just for the sake of redundancy here and for uniformity, just hit the very high points of what's involved in a standard IVF process, a procedure.
Sure. So IVF involves stimulating a woman's ovaries so that instead of producing just one mature egg within a month, she would produce several eggs, typically somewhere between 5 and 15 or more. And then using an ultrasound probe, a needle is guided through the vaginal wall into the ovary, taking out the mature eggs, and these are then mixed with sperm in a petri dish to allow for fertilization, or a sperm would be directly inserted into the interior of the egg, what we call ICSI. And then this inseminated egg would be observed in the laboratory over the next several days to document fertilization and embryo development. And then generally after about 5 days now, the embryos would be evaluated, and the best embryo would be transferred back into the uterus. In the case of an older woman, perhaps more than one embryo might be transferred back. And then additional embryos would be frozen for potential later use.
Okay. Now, do that same thing for an IUI procedure, also known as intrauterine insemination, or some people call it artificial insemination. So kind of walk us through the basics of that process.
Right. So like IVF, IUI is a fertility-boosting strategy that's employed with certain types of infertility, mild, moderate male factors, unexplained infertility. It's not so suitable for, say, tubal blockages as IVF would be. But in this scenario, the ovaries are stimulated, although generally not to the degree that they would be for IVF. Superovulation of two or three eggs is typically achieved with drugs like clomiphene citrate. And at the day of ovulation, the semen sample is collected, sperm are processed in such a way to purify the best, the most highly moving sperm, and then that purified specimen would be delivered with a small catheter through the cervical canal into the uterus, a very minor process. So the idea is to create more eggs than would generally be achieved in a natural cycle, and then to have more sperm that would be available to potentially fertilize those eggs. So the pregnancy rates with insemination are generally significantly lower than with in vitro fertilization, but the procedure is typically chosen because it's lower tech and may involve less monitoring and certainly less expensive.
Or because insurance requires that certain number of IUIs be done before they will pay for an IVF. Unfortunately, that still happens as well. Go ahead.
That's if the insurance companies even pay for fertility treatments. So some states are lucky enough to have mandates where coverage is there. Other states, like the one I'm in, Texas, unfortunately, there is no infertility mandate. So it's fairly rare that couples would have or individuals would have coverage for in vitro fertilization.
That's exactly right, yes. Recurring topic that we talk about here at Creating a Family as well. Now, how does intravaginal culture, it also is sometimes known as IVC, or it's also sometimes known by InvoCell, or the Invo procedure, because I believe they're the only ones who are actually producing this this device and this procedure. So how does intravaginal culture differ from from both of those, the IVF procedure you described and the IUI procedure?
So the Invo cell provides a mechanism to perform in vitro fertilization outside of the laboratory. And this is important because the laboratory is what contributes greatly to the cost of an IVF cycle. The embryos are not really not capable of surviving in the air we breathe. There are things in the air that that are problematic, not just the particles that might contaminate with bacteria, but there are volatile organic compounds, what we call VOCs, that are toxic to embryos. So the IVF laboratory has to be a very, very clean room with very sophisticated air handling systems to remove these, whereas this is kind of more natural. So the fertilization and embryo development happens in a little capsule that's placed in the vagina, and this capsule allows the flow of things like carbon dioxide and oxygen so that the embryo is able to get what it needs, but it relies on the woman's lungs, kidneys, liver to filter out all these impurities in the air. So it allows for good embryo development outside of a high-tech environment.
Does it also require the use of a culture medium, which is, just for our audience, that is the substance that's put in the Petri dish that nourishes, I guess would be the correct word, the developing embryo. Does the IVC device, the intravaginal culture device, require outside culture, or is the woman's vaginal environment a culture enough?
So it does require a culture medium. The device actually has an outer chamber whose purpose is to really keep the inner chamber sterile and prevent contamination with bacteria. And then the inner chamber holds the media that would then the inseminated eggs would be placed in that culture media within that inner chamber. So it's very similar to IVF in that sense. It uses the same standard media that is used in current laboratories.
Is this correct to say this is an alternative to IVF, or is it just another form of IVF? Because it sounds to me like maybe I should ask the obvious question to begin with, which is, do you go through an egg retrieval process? You would have to, otherwise you wouldn't have eggs to put in. So you go through and we're going to talk in a minute about the differences in stimulation that are often used, but you would still go through an ovulatory stimulation using probably injectables, I would assume, or maybe not. We'll talk about that in a minute. And then you would have to go through the egg retrieval process, which is generally done under sedation or some sort. And then you have the eggs that you put in. So other than the culturing, is it very similar to an IVF process?
It is very similar to IVF. It has the exact same process of the egg retrieval, a little different and the laboratory technique. So right at egg retrieval, the sperm and egg are mixed together for just a couple minutes and then placed into the device, and the device is then placed into the woman, into the vaginal canal. But it is I would call it a different flavor of IVF. It is in vitro fertilization, but it's drastically simplified.
Right, okay, that makes good sense to me. Now, In a natural conception, where does the fertilization and the very early embryo development take place?
So the fertilization takes place in the fallopian tube, and for the first several days, the development of the embryo takes place in the fallopian tube. Finally, at about 5 days after ovulation, the developing embryo, and at that time it would be a blastocyst embryo, that would make its way into the uterine cavity where it would then be able to hatch and implant. And that's why,
okay,
with current IVF process, we culture for 5 days to get to that blastocyst stage to return that blastocyst embryo to the environment that it should be at, the uterine cavity.
So is the environment of the vagina comparable to the environment of the fallopian tubes, which is I would assume the ideal scenario would be to mimic as closely as possible the fallopian tubes. But how does the vaginal environment compare to the environment of the fallopian tubes?
So the media provides the same, I would call it solution chemistry, that the embryo would be seeing within the fallopian tube. The vagina provides the exact temperature that's required, the same temperature that would be in the fallopian tube, and interestingly, that's really different than the artificial temperature that our embryos are maintained at in the laboratory. So I think that's a clear advantage. The other similarity to the fallopian tube is the gas environment. So the fallopian tube and the vagina and the whole reproductive tract is a low oxygen tension, much lower than atmospheric air, and it has a higher carbon dioxide environment. And this CO2 environment maintains the pH of the media at the appropriate place.
Okay, so it's not identical, it is similar, or perhaps the better way to say it would be more similar than you would find in a lab. Why would, I'm just curious, why would the culturing in a lab, why would you not try to mimic the temperature of the fallopian tubes, which I assume would be close to 98.6?
That's a great question. Well, that's exactly what they do. So the incubators are set at 98.6 or 37 degrees centigrade, but that's really not the female temperature. So we know, you're probably familiar with basal body temperature readings. So we know,
right,
that there's quite a large variance of temperature on a diurnal, on a daily basis, where it starts low in the morning and then it cycles up high as activity, as physical activity happens, and then in the evening when people start to rest, it dips down again. That's a few degree fluctuation, and that the IVF incubators, I think it was a lack of insight with regard to that fluctuation. These IVF incubators follow what we consider a good quality assurance. You know, in the laboratory, we think we want to avoid variance, this Six Sigma approach. And so our thermostats and our incubators are designed to be very tightly maintained at 37 degrees centigrade, but the human embryo has not evolved hundreds of thousands of years at that static temperature. And I think it's kind of like the seasons. If we were to get rid of the seasons and it was the same temperature and daylight all year round, you'd get rid of, you know, the cherry blossoms in Washington, D.C. It would be very hard to sustain normal biological processes. Complex organic systems actually like predictable variance. The human embryo has been exposed to that for hundreds of thousands of years, and I think it's learned not just to tolerate that variance, but to exploit it.
Yeah, and that makes actually very good sense. And we have a question from Lynn. It's a little long. She says, I'm absolutely fascinated by this topic and this technique. Thank you so much for doing this show. Thank you for listening to us when we ask for it. You're welcome, Lynn. And then she says, why would you not insert the fertilized egg into the fallopian tubes and have them culture there? Which I thought was a great question. So, Dr. Doody, If we're trying to mimic the advice of the environment of the fallopian tube, why not just do the culturing there?
That's a great question, and in fact, we used to do that. So there were two procedures called GIFT and ZIFT that were used very frequently in the late 80s and very early 90s. So what we would do with these procedures is identical to IVF in terms of stimulation of the ovaries and taking the eggs out, but in the case of GIFT, the eggs and sperm would be placed into the fallopian tube at laparoscopy, so it's a more major procedure. Or, in the case of ZIFT, or tubal embryo transfer, ZIFT stands for zygote intrafallopian transfer, the eggs would be fertilized in the laboratory, and then after a given time frame, then a laparoscopy would be performed, and these early embryos or fertilized eggs would be placed into the tubes. The problem with that is that not every egg is good, and not every sperm is good, so not every embryo will implant, and that's one of the benefits of in vitro fertilization is we get to have multiple eggs that are exposed to sperm and develop into embryos, and then based on certain criteria, we can identify which of these fertilized eggs or embryo is more likely to implant. So in the case of GIFT, yes, it had excellent pregnancy rates, but the downside was to get those rates, you had to put at least two eggs and sperm in each fallopian tube, total of four eggs, and pregnancy rates were good, but when it rains, it sometimes pours, and multiple pregnancy rates were unacceptably high.
And wasn't there a higher than average, I think I've read this, higher than average ectopic pregnancy from both the GIFT and the ZIFT techniques?
So sometimes it's very difficult to tell whether the infertility is related to a tubal factor. Some fallopian tubes are blocked or have an outward appearance of being very diseased, but sometimes this is happening in the interior of the tube where we're not able to identify it. And so some infertility is really tubal-based, and the fertilized eggs would have a hard time getting all the way down into the uterus. So, yes,
right. Okay.
Tubal pregnancies can certainly happen.
All right. Now let's go back to talking about the InvoCell system or the InvoCell procedure. How large is the device that's going to be inserted and the woman will carry for 3 days? We didn't say that, but I believe 3 days is the average, 72 hours is the average amount of time that the device is left in place. So how large is this device?
Somebody has described this as a champagne cork. So it's a little smaller than that, I think that's a good reference point.
Okay. And where is it positioned in the vagina?
So it's positioned high in the vagina, up toward the cervix.
Is it comfortable? I mean, does it? I'm sitting here imagining that it would feel like that it would pop out with a good cough or a sneeze.
Yeah, no, it really doesn't. So for women that have had vaginal deliveries and their vaginal opening may be more lax, could be a possibility. So there is a retention device that can be used in tandem with the InvoCell, which is a little diaphragm with holes in it to keep it in place. But the InvoCell, the system is actually very, very well tolerated, and most patients don't feel it once it's been placed.
It's just in there and you're not even aware of it. Is the woman on limited activity during the 3-day time that the device is in place?
They're not on limited activity. First of all, we use it for 5 days because we do like to get to the blastocyst stage.
That question. Go ahead.
And the only limitation in activity is no intercourse. So if it's in the vagina, we don't want anything else going in there.
Yeah, that would make sense. All right, so a normal activity is, and I'm glad you clarified that. It can be, because one of my questions was, we have been talking so much in the last probably 2 years or thereabouts, 2-3 years, about the advantages of growing embryos to the blastocyst stage, which would be the 5-day stage, and improvements in pregnancy rates and things associated with that. So I was, one of my questions was, if the IVC devices are only growing up to 3 days, do we lose that advantage? But it sounds like my information was incorrect when I saw that the 72 hours was what was recommended. So you're able to grow the embryos to the blastocyst stage in the InvoCell device. Is that correct?
That's correct. So when I first was exposed to the device, and a gentleman from Canada, Jason Broom, was showing me the device, he talked about how its effectiveness had been demonstrated for 3 days of culture, as you described, for 72 hours. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really interested in that. We've been doing blastocyst culture in all of our patients since January of 1998. So I did a series of pilot studies to make sure that it would be good for extended embryo culture, and it certainly is.
Excellent. Okay, that makes very good sense. All right, everyone, you are listening to Creating a Family, and today we are talking about intravaginal culture as a form of IVF. I guess you could say it's a different form of culturing through IVF. And our guest is Dr. Kevin Duty. He is the president of the Society for Assisted Reproductive Technology. He is also a reproductive endocrinologist with CARE Fertility in Dallas and Fort Worth, and he is medical director and on the board of directors for the Invo Bioscience, which is a manufacturer of the InvoCell, which is one type of the intravaginal culture system. Clout now ranks Creating a Family as the number 2 online influencer worldwide in the area of infertility. We primarily hang out in the social networks at Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. There are 3 ways to connect with us on Facebook. You can connect with me personally, and that's dawn.davenport1, or you can connect with our Facebook page. You could like that page, and you get to that by facebook.com/creatingafamily, or you can join our very active support group where we've been talking about intravaginal culture and the in vivo cell process, as well as many other things. And to get to our support group, you would go to facebook.com/groups/creatingafamily. Or the easiest way to find us on Facebook is just to type in the words Creating a Family in the Facebook search box, and you can like the page and join the group. It is a closed group, so it is not open to others. Nobody else can see the comments there other than members, so you'll have to request to join. And usually once or twice a week, we look through the members and allow those in. On Twitter and Pinterest, you can find us at Creating a Family. All right. I had promised that we would get into the stimulation aspects as well. As you described, Dr. Duty, at the beginning, the standard typical IVF, I think it goes by the one and done. In fact, I'm presenting at a conference in Chicago next week on a topic, and one of the other presenters is a reproductive endocrinologist, and I believe the title of his is One and Done, his presentation, which means that the idea is to get as many eggs through one stimulation cycle as possible. So that's, I know that there are some clinics who don't follow that philosophy, but that is a common philosophy for infertility clinics to and reproductive endocrinologists to follow. Now, why would you not take that same approach with the intravaginal culture or the in vivo cell process?
So one could take that strategy. I will say that there is some good evidence that quantity, increasing the quantity of eggs, doesn't always result in an increased number of good eggs, and that sometimes mm-hmm. by using higher dosages of medications, we're simply recruiting, growing smaller follicles that would have been on their way to degeneration, et cetera. So, but on the other side of that, certainly the natural cycle and the minimal stimulation approaches to IVF have not proven to be nearly as effective as the conventional stimulation protocols. So what we have done is, so our goal here is to increase access to care, to make this process, number one, more affordable, but number two, potentially available in geographic areas that are underserved as far as IVF. So because of the demanding infrastructure of a conventional IVF clinic, they're really located almost exclusively in large urban areas. So people that live in towns of 250,000 or that are
That's
away
right.
from urban mm-hmm. areas really don't have access. So
That's
our
exactly
approach
right.
has been to use a blood test that's been recently approved, the AMH test, which is a predictor of ovarian response. And we combine that with the body weight to come up with a defined dosing strategy that doesn't require all this frequent monitoring during the IVF process, so that we can limit the number of monitoring visits to two or three total, and they're done with sonograms only, not blood estrogen levels and other hormones. And our target with this is generally not to get 15 or 20 eggs, because again, when you get 15, 20, 30 eggs, most of those really aren't going to be healthy eggs. So we typically are trying to target about 6 to 8. Sometimes we get under that. Sometimes we get over that. We've had as many as 19 eggs that we've put in the InvoCell device, and we've had excellent outcomes with that in terms of fertilization and embryo development. But our goal is to really make a procedure that's more widely available, that's more affordable, that doesn't have the time burdens and sometimes the emotional burdens that are associated with the stress of all these monitoring visits, and combine that with the InvoCell, which is, again, a more natural system where the fertilization and embryo development happens within the body. The woman doesn't, not that it happens commonly, but the woman doesn't have to worry about her eggs or embryos being mixed up with others. And
it's also the emotional of feeling that you have contributed something, that your body has contributed something to help grow these embryos, because quite frankly, very often women come into fertility treatment having felt like they failed, or their body has failed them, and this is a way of giving them some degree of, or a feeling of some degree of control.
I think you're totally right with that, and there's also just a feeling that it's more natural.
Yes. Okay, so there isn't really a limit on, well, there probably is at some point a limit, but for the most part, you've as many eggs as you can retrieve can be placed in the device, in the intravaginal culture device.
I will say that package insert or the FDA approval was based on some prior studies where the average egg numbers were low, and it was done with 3 days of culture. And so the package insert, puts certain limits on how the device is marketed. Having said that, in IVF, I'm sure you're aware, we use many things off-label. Progesterone, intramuscular progesterone, things like luprolide acetate, mm-hmm. Lupron. These are not intended uses, and we're allowed to do that if we know that it's safe and effective and a good way to do things. And so the amount
of
volume.
You brought that up because I was confused, because I had thought that the FDA had only approved for 3 days of culture, but if I'm understanding you correctly, that may be what got that FDA approved on, but it is but doctors have leeway to use for as long as they would choose. In this case, you have said that would indicate 5 days.
If you look at the package insert for the fertility drug, say Gonalef, so it's approved for women over 45 taking 225 international units a day, and under 35, 150 internationally. Well, that's not how we use it commonly, right? So, these instructions that are allowed to be on the market, in the materials that accompany the device, are useful as a starting point, but it's ultimately at the discretion of the physician how to use it. And the volume of media, and the reason that I feel very comfortable using larger numbers of eggs, the volume of media in the device can be anywhere from, if you have an oil overlay in it like we do, is about 750 0.75 milliliters, which is a very big volume. So to put that in context, that 750 microliter volume would be 15 times as big as culturing in the standard 50 microliter drop in the laboratory. So so there's plenty of room there for the embryos and plenty of nutrients to support their growth even for an extended time frame.
So the use of minimal stimulation, which for our audience, which I think probably know this, but that would be ovulatory stimulation, so the gonadotropin. So the use of minimal or lesser quantities of gonadotropins or stimulation is, it sounds like, then twofold, if I'm understanding you correctly. One, it is because you're hoping to get as high a quality eggs as possible, and two, we all know that the infertility medication is costly and is a large part of the cost, and I would assume that this also helps reduce the cost, which is encouraging access to care as well. Did I summarize correctly the reasons why you use minimal stimulation?
Yeah, I would say that I don't describe the stimulation the approach we use as minimal. Some people might have that description. I would say it's minimal monitoring. A lot of times when people talk about minimal stimulation, they're talking about using drugs like Clomid or letrozole in conjunction with a little bit of gonadotropin. We're using conventional stimulation techniques. We're just tailoring the dosage of the gonadotropin to the patient's body weight and their AMH, so we're not overdosing patients, we're hopefully not underdosing patients. We're trying to get that sweet spot where we're getting the largest cohort of really good eggs that we can get. And again, there's some good studies showing that going to a higher amount, yes, you get more eggs, but you don't get more good eggs. So I would describe this as an individually tailored, not minimal, but mild conventional stimulation.
Gotcha. Okay, so as someone who has looked at embryos that have been cultured via the InvoCell device or the procedure, and those that are cultured using the standard procedure, and I realize you're not an embryologist, but you can either speak for the embryologist you work with or from your own experience, can you see either through the microscope or any other way that you look at embryos, can you see any difference between the two different techniques for growing embryos?
Yes, actually we do. So, of course, bad embryos, genetically abnormal embryos, will most often look not very good in any culture system. But what we noticed was that the good embryos tend to be more advanced with the intravaginal culture. So whereas ordinarily our best embryos on day five in the conventional laboratory incubation systems in any clinic would be generally what we would call a 4AA embryo on the Gardner scale classification scheme. And that's fully expanded, high numbers of cells in the inner and outer cell masses. What we see in the InvoCell is very commonly hatching or fully hatched blastocysts. That's what really brought about this concept that actually that variance in temperature is more physiologic, more normal, and perhaps this is a lesson we can bring back to the regular IVF lab and design incubators to be more physiologic in terms of temperature to get that better.
What would be the grading?
To get that
the grading equivalent of a fully hatched. You said 4AA.
So 5AA would be a top quality hatching, and 6AA would be top quality fully hatched. And we, even in our first pilot, we were seeing these, what the heck is going on here? We have 6AA fully hatched embryos, which we'd really never seen before.
Well, how much how much research has been done? That's absolutely fascinating, and that result would be huge to me. So, how much research has been published on utilizing this technique of intravaginal culture?
There have been a few publications. So this device has only recently been approved by the FDA in the United States, but it had been used in Colombia and in India, and it was some of that clinical data that that helped contribute to the FDA approval. I began to use the device on a research basis again a couple years ago, and because I wanted to use it in extended culture and with an easy, minimally monitored stimulation, we did a randomized prospective clinical trial comparing the vaginal culture system to the conventional incubators in all patients, though, with this minimal, mild conventional stimulation. And we published that a year ago in the Journal of Assisted Reproduction and Genetics.
Yeah, it was in 2016, I believe, yeah.
2016.
Okay. Yeah, and the size of the studies, because this, I think it's important to note, I think it was only approved for use in the U.S., 2015, is that when it was?
It's been about a year and a year and a half.
Okay, so I guess a little after than 2016. So understandably, there has not been a large amount of research, at least research done in the U.S., but are the size of the studies relatively small, given that it's relatively new? One of the things we always talk about here is trying to train people how to understand research, and certainly we're looking for large sample sizes, longitudinal if possible, that type of stuff, randomized, all the things you just mentioned. But has any of that, have the sample sizes been very big, given that not that much, we haven't been doing that very long in the U.S.?
No, the sample sizes are very small. I would regard what we did as a pilot study. Certainly, it was a proof of concept that demonstrated that we could get high birth rates using the system and using the mild stimulation. But comparisons to conventional stimulation, and if we're going to look at one issue or another, gosh, when a pharmaceutical company tries to get a new follicle-stimulating hormone drug approved these days, the FDA requires that they do huge studies. And about maybe 3,000 patients undergoing IVF. And, of course, those studies are very expensive and very hard to do.
Yep. Yeah. All right. One of the things you mentioned earlier that I want to circle back to, and that is the use of this device, the in vivo cell device, to increase access to care. Access to care is a recurring topic for us here at Creating a Family. We are committed to that and to promoting that as well. One of the things that I read was that this technique and the in vivo cell technique, or procedure, I guess, it can be done in, and the quote I took out was, appropriately trained physicians' offices. Does that mean that it can be done by a regular gynecologist or an internist or even a GP? Is this a possibility?
So I would hope that we can train some physicians, say good gynecologists who have good surgical hands, to be able to expand the geography of this to the, and I'm going to use some cities in Texas that are far away from urban areas but are pretty big cities, like Abilene and Wichita Falls and Tyler. And, there are a lot of cities, again, in that 150,000, 200,000 range, that it's going to be hard to get a reproductive endocrinologist to locate because the volume is not going to be very high. Yet the demands of travel for, say, a working couple to be able to do all the steps in a conventional IVF process really, even if they could afford it, make it very, very difficult for couples to do this. So so I would hope we can train, you know, you're not going to want to train every gynecologist to do this, but I think it would be appropriate, and this can be used under the direction of a, you know, subspecialty certified reproductive endocrinologist. But I would hope we can expand it.
Well, and you talked about standardizing the dosing as well, or simplifying it, I guess would be the more accurate word there, because it's not really standardized, by just basing it on AMH and body weight. And that would be, I suppose, could be done by a gynecologist or under the supervision of a reproductive endocrinologist. So that gives you a feel from a dosing standpoint of what to use. And that would also lower cost and increase access, I would assume, would it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely it would. And because we've eliminated the need for these stat estradiol levels, so IVF centers currently have to have an ability, you know, with conventional IVF, you want to be able to get the patient in the morning, do their sonogram, draw their blood, be able to get the results of that hormonal testing back to be able to contact the patient later in the day to give them further instructions with regarding dosing. Well, if we can, you know, get rid of that hormonal testing and the micromanagement that has, you know, that has evolved, I think, into in most cases unnecessarily complex manipulations, then we can make this, yeah, less expensive and able to be done in locations where that kind of resource is not available.
Can embryos created with this process be frozen for subsequent frozen embryo transfers?
Yes, so we do. The embryos, so we would generally want to transfer one or at most two, depending upon the patient's age, but we don't want the extra, you know, bonus good-looking embryos to go to waste. So we encourage them to be vitrified, you know, at on the day that that the first embryo is transferred back.
Can you do PGS, pre-implantation genetic screening, on these embryos?
You know, you can, but I think that gets away from the model of what I call effortless IVF. So it is just an incubation system, and you could certainly take out the embryos and biopsy them and then freeze and send the biopsied specimen off to a laboratory. What we've tried to develop is a process that can be done without micromanipulation techniques. I think in this country we overutilize things like ICSI and pre-implantation genetic screening, and the ability for and it's great that embryologists have those hands-on technical skills, but those come at a cost. There's tremendous training that's involved. Using the InvoCell device as a simplified IVF requires much less skill level, so people can be trained more quickly, and the whole process can be less expensive. Once you start to add on ICSI and PGS, PGD, I think that the needs for those really they're not so appropriate for this type of a system.
All right, so now let's get to the brass tacks and let's talk success. What are the success rates using intravaginal culture versus the success rates for traditional IVF?
So the success rates, the biggest factor will always be the age of the woman that's contributing the eggs. In the pilot study that we did, we accepted women up to age 38. And we included at that time only predicted normal responders, those with AMHs that weren't too high or too low. And in that group, we had chemical pregnancy rates in both groups of 70%, clinical pregnancy rates in both groups of 65%, you know, sonogram identified gestational sac, and and heartbeat, but live birth rates were 55% in the vaginal culture arm and 60% in the traditional laboratory incubator arm. Again, these were all using the mild stimulations. Is that a big enough, as you said, is that a big enough group of patients to really know what the success rates are at every age or if there are any subtle differences? Absolutely not. We need more detail. One thing that SART is doing is we've added the field for intravaginal culture. So this, as of 2016, is being collected. And so we'll be able to track and monitor outcomes of intravaginal culture and compare and contrast that with conventional IVF or ICSI.
Good for you. That's great. Because then we'll have large numbers, although only large numbers up as this becomes a more procedure that's more standardly done. You'll have more numbers. I didn't realize that. I didn't realize that SART was going to be starting to collect that data, which is great. That's perfect. All right, so then the other brass tacks topic that we always end up having to talk about when we talk about fertility treatment, and that is cost. So how does the cost compare from a INVO procedure cost versus a traditional IVF cost?
It's about half. So in our center, the conventional IVF cycle is $8,500, plus there's the cost of the medications, which can be about $4,500. So you're looking at an average of about $13,000. With our InvoCell effortless IVF program, it's a $4,500 physician, facility, anesthesia, you know, all those costs bundled. And then the medication cost is lower for two reasons. One is we're using a lower dosing scheme, and two, the pharmaceutical company has actually is also excited about improving access to care. So they've partnered to decrease the cost of the medication that's used very significantly. So overall cost, including medications, is about $6,500 for the average patient.
You know, you're exactly right. That's about right at half or a little more than half. Interesting. Okay. All right, so the advantages that we've talked about for using intravaginal culture are not so much less medication, although in your effortless IVF approach, you are using less than some others, but we would call it not necessarily minimal. So, but an advantage would be certainly cost. We've talked some about the emotional advantages, greater involvement. I suppose if somebody is truly obsessing over the risk of embryo mix-up, that would certainly add an emotional boon to them, although we've done a lot here to stress what people can do to lower that risk and lower their anxiety, quite frankly, because the reality is most centers have fairly good procedures in place. But if patients ask and find out what those procedures are, we often find that anxiety diminishes anyway. And so those are definitely some advantages and greater access to care from a geographic standpoint. That potential exists as well. Some of the disadvantages, I was going to say the PGS, but if that was important to you, you could still have genetic screening done. This is just a different method of culture, so if that's important, it gets away from the cost savings, but nonetheless, that would be. I had wondered when I had been reading, and you're right, I was reading the package inserts, which were limiting the number of embryos that could be placed in the device. I wondered if that wouldn't ultimately be a disadvantage because it seemed like fewer embryos would mean more repeated tries and ultimately more cost. But if I'm understanding what you said earlier, that really the way it is actually being practiced in the United States, the amount of embryos you could culture would be similar to what you would be culturing in a traditional IVF. Am I repeating what you told me correctly?
I think that's exactly right. And again, we've done up to 19 fertilized eggs and embryos in the device. When we get beyond that, even in our conventional IVF patients, when we're stimulating more aggressively, typically we counsel our patients for them to consider freezing the extra eggs, freezing eggs beyond 20 anyway, just to avoid couples having to face what sometimes can be an ethical concern of what to do with these embryos that they've created once they've finished building their family.
Exactly.
It can be very, very difficult for some couples to come to terms with that, what the disposition would be. So.
Yeah, we do a lot. We do a lot of discussion of that here. Yeah, I will tell you, I'm glad to hear you realize that it is a difficult decision, because quite frankly, when I've spoken with some medical doctors, just because from their mind it shouldn't be a difficult decision, they have little appreciation that it knowing what to do with excess embryos can be very difficult for some people, not for all at all. I mean, many people, for them, it's simply not a big issue, but for others, it is a big issue. So that is certainly something to consider. I suppose I would throw out, you know, since we've talked about the emotional advantages, and I can certainly see that there would be some for using what is perceived to be a more natural culture technique, as well as allowing the woman's body to, you know, to do something right, as we've heard women say. In fact, we got a comment. Unfortunately, we did get questions for this show. They were all just rather relatively general, but we did get one from somebody who said that it would. She was interested because it would allow her body to do one damn thing right. That's a quote. So, but it also occurs to me that it could also have an emotional disadvantage if it was not effective, and the embryos did not grow. It would just. I suppose it could also, that from the emotional standpoint, that could be a double-edged sword. I don't know if you've seen any of that in your experience with utilizing the intravaginal culture.
Well, fortunately, it's a good culture system, so we don't. I can imagine that there might be a circumstance that that we've not encountered where a woman were to get sick and have a fever or something that would provide a less than optimal environment. So we would definitely not encourage this in people who are susceptible to that frequently. But it's a good culture system. So I don't think there would be, if the eggs don't fertilize or they don't develop well, it's likely not related to the woman's body temperature or her other characteristics. Mm-hmm. It's likely just a sperm problem or an egg problem or both.
Got it. And so it's not the culture, it's not her vagina that did not do, it's culturing well, I guess. And I would assume that traditional medium for embryo culture is sterile. And while the vagina is certainly not dirty, it's also not necessarily sterile. Is there a risk for infection to the culture, to the embryos, not for the woman necessarily, that this type of culture is more prone to?
So the intravaginal culture was first conceived of, as a pun, about 30 years ago, and at that point it was using improvised devices, not specifically designed for vaginal culture, and that was a not unfrequent complication. This device is really elegantly designed to avoid that. And one thing that has been done and the FDA required is extremely rigorous testing to show that the inside of the inner chamber of the media remains sterile even when bathed in a soup of bacteria and stirred around in that soup of bacteria for several days.
Excellent.
So it could be a problem with intravaginal culture, but not with this device.
So who would you say is the prime candidate for considering intravaginal culture?
So I think I'll go the opposite way and say that I think that the patients that are not good candidates are severe male factors that need ICSI, people who are undergoing IVF to prevent transmission of inheritable genetic diseases that need PGD, those are not the good candidates. I think that really patients that have tubal factor, mild, moderate sperm issues, ovulatory problems, unexplained infertility, these are all good candidates for the INVOcell.
Okay, and then last question we're going to have time for. As I mentioned, this has been a topic of great interest, actually. I mean, not just because it's new, but because it's less expensive, and I think you're right that there is an attraction to a feeling that it is more, and I'm using air quotes here, natural, more less involvement with medical science, I suppose. I think that might be overstating some people's thoughts, but nonetheless, that there's a great deal of interest. So if people are interested in finding a clinic that offers intravaginal culture, or in this case, that would be the INVO procedure process, utilizing the INVOcell device, so how would they find, how do they go about finding a clinic? Because not every clinic is currently offering this.
Well, they can go to the INVO Bioscience website, and the website lists the has a listing of all the clinics that that have been trained and are certified to use the device.
Okay, and I'm going to give that. That is INVO, I-N-V-O, bioscience.com. Thank you so much, Dr. Kevin Duty, for being on our show today to talk about what I personally find a fascinating topic. Let me remind our audience to keep in mind that the information given in this interview is general advice. To understand how it applies to your specific situation, please work with your infertility professional. Also, please, everyone, do us a favor and pop over to iTunes podcast and give us a rating. It is we are ranked number one by far in this subject matter, in this topic area, and we would love to keep it. We are actually, I believe, still on the iTunes homepage under What's Hot. We would love to maintain our position there as well, and your ratings truly help us, and I would very much appreciate it. To get more information, I've already given you the InvoBioscience.com website, and that would get you information on the INVO procedure in general, the INVOcell device. To get more information about Dr. Doty, his website for his clinic, which is Care Fertility in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, is embryo.net. He also has a separate website. He mentioned Effortless IVF, and they have a separate website where you can get more information about that process, which he has described more on the show today, and that URL is effortlessivf.com. Again, embryo.net for the clinic itself, Effortless IVF for the information specific to using intravaginal culture. Thank you so much for joining us today, everyone, and I will see you next week.
The kids and I just got back from King's Dominion, and can you hear that? That's the sound of the best day ever. Sure, there were some screams, like when they saw that Planet Snoopy is bigger than ever with three new rides, or when I found out there's enough fun there to keep them busy all summer long. My scream was louder.
Get a free 2017 pre-K pass for kids age 3 to 5 at kingsdominion.com. Offer ends April 30th.
Support for this podcast comes from Atlantic.net, a hosting solution provider of healthcare HIPAA, PCI compliance, and ad tech. If you are feeling the pain of having outdated technology, call Atlantic.net and get the latest security firewall, intrusion detection, backup, disaster recovery, and virtualization. Whether you're starting fresh or need a new provider, Atlantic.net can help you succeed with fully audited solutions and 23 years of experience. Visit Atlantic.net to learn more.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the...
Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, blah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.